I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. Republican presidential candidates were not happy about the CNBC debate last week.
Moderators just didn't do their job last night in a number of areas. Not only were the questions snarky and divisive and non-substantive, they were just biased.
I think they obviously had an agenda. When I compare them to the kind of questions that were asked of the Democrats in their debate, the difference is night and day.
It was all about the horse race.
The moderators seemed to be a bit biased with all of their questions.
The questions were so nasty.
Every question is an insult. Every question is an attack. Every question is asking one Republican to attack another Republican. You know, they don't do that to the Democrats.
The campaigns met on Sunday to put together a list of demands: bathroom breaks, the choice of moderators, the temperature of the room, the chyrons and banners, opening and closing statements, no show of hands, questions. But it turns out the candidates are not all on the same page. The next debate is next week on the Fox Business Channel. Today on Radio Times, we talk about this controversy, the fallout from the CNBC debate, and what, for that matter, makes for a good debate. And we have two guests who have joined us by phone. Alan Schroeder is a professor in the School of Journalism at Northeastern University in Boston. He's the author of several books, including Presidential Debates, 50 Years of High-Risk TV. Alan Schroeder, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
Also with us is Jim Warren, and he's a contributing editor at U.S. News and World Report, an award-winning reporter, columnist, and editor. He's also chief media writer for the Poynter Institute for Media Studies. And Jim Warren, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hey, my pleasure, guys.
Let me begin with you, Jim, if I could. What happened to those list of demands that came out of that meeting on Sunday?
They lasted, what, about 24 hours?
Something like that.
A very prominent Washington Republican attorney, sat there in the room as kind of facilitator at the Hilton Hotel in Alexandria, Virginia, and tried to get the 14 surrogates for 14 of the 15 candidates who showed up on the same page, literally, in a draft one-page statement as to what they might ask or mandate of the networks. And by the next point, it was clear that they couldn't get any agreement and that there were, no surprise, a lot of clashing self-interests. Some people wanted to have a higher profile, some wanted a lower profile, some felt, incumbent to be able to pick the moderator. Others didn't feel that was such a priority. Others, I think, were a little bit anxious about the image of, Republicans haranguing the media and insisting on getting their way. And then there was, the specter of Donald Trump doing what the hell he wanted to do, regardless of what the rest of the group did, particularly as long as he's got the leverage of knowing that millions are going to be tuning in for a while just to see him. So absolutely nothing happened. And another goal of theirs, maybe a primary goal, which was to get the Republican National Committee out of the process, because they were all pointing fingers at their own party for having botched things with the CNBC debate. It's really unclear to me what now happens going forward. I suspect, someone's going to have to serve as the role of intermediary during the primary process. It's very different when you get to the general election and you actually have a commission which is impaneled and they will oversee it. But right now, it's kind of a free market deal with folks just dealing on an ad hoc basis with the different cable and broadcast networks.
Well, Alan, let me pick up on that. And what's so interesting, as Jim was just saying, is that these a number of these candidates and their teams are really fighting with Reince Priebus, who negotiated with the networks on the numbers of these debates, also who would be hosting the debates, wanting to bring, I think, a little more a law and order from the last go-round. But their problem seems to be with the head of their own party. What do you make of that?
Right. Well, it's a typical case of you're always refighting the last battle. And so a lot of these remedies that were put in place for this year are speaking to the 2012 field and the thought that there had been too many debates. The RNC actually did, I think, a pretty good job in curbing the number of debates. There are only going to be 9 or 10, assuming everything plays out according to plan, as opposed to more than 20 last cycle. So I think, the the candidates have actually had some gains by the RNC and its involvement in this process. But what nobody anticipated was this enormous field of candidates. So for the first time, we're having these undercard debates followed by primetime debates. There's a lot of unhappiness over that. The huge number of people on stage means really limited response times, very superficial conversations. So, you know, it's a case of good intentions, I think, gone awry on the part of the RNC.
But, Alan, and to you, Jim, as well, but these debates are seeing huge audiences. People are tuning in. What do you make of that, Alan?
Well, I think that perhaps the fact that there are fewer of the debates means that people are more likely to tune into the ones that do exist. But I think, you know, Donald Trump, there's no question. I agree with, you know, Jim's point there that Donald Trump is kind of off to the side, his own animal. And I think that he's attracted, especially initially, an awful lot of the interest. But, you know, it's a little bit of the mini-series effect that once you buy in and that first debate drew 24 million viewers, that you're kind of invested in watching how the other debates play out. And it's always that classic thing of live television. You do not know what's going to happen in a debate, and it could be very boring or it could be, you know, quite interesting. So I think people like that spontaneity. It's a very rare commodity in modern politics.
To you, Jim, and I do want to play, we put together a montage of some of the questions from the CNBC debate. But before we even get to that, and we heard it in the very first montage that we played, do you think the questions were snarky and nasty and kind of gotcha questions, Jim?
No, I mean, I think a couple, you know, I might have, if I was an editor, might have redrafted. I wouldn't have wasted the minutes at the beginning asking folks, you know, what their biggest screw-ups were, what their biggest weaknesses were. Come on. who's going to answer that honestly? I mean, I thought that was silly. And if you think that they had, you know, months to prepare this stuff. And then the question that my good friend, a really great journalist, John Harwood, asked Trump, you know, an off-quoted line about, isn't this sort of a comic book presidential campaign you're running? I might have suggested to my friend, slightly altering the phrasing there. But, you know, by and large, I thought they, you know, did a fairly decent job dealing with, you know, the structural impossibility, the structural challenge of 10 people. It's inherently unwieldy. A bunch of folks have got their scripted remarks who, in many cases, are going to answer the question that they want to answer. In many cases, are going to avoid what you're telling them. In the case of Ben Carson, simply refusing to acknowledge the facts that his tax plan, whether it was a 10% flat tax or 15% flat tax, was still going to contribute to the deficit. I mean, what do you do if you're somebody like Becky Quick, the co-host, who had done her homework, had crunched the numbers, presumably with lots of expert folks, and presents the guy with what those numbers would mean, and the guy simply denies it? Well, what, you know, I guess you just go on to the next question. And then Harwood later on, you know, what was a double-edged sword for him, you know, is dealing with candidates who refuse to respect the time limits. And he had to, you know, outshout them to tell them basically, shut up, guys. Time's up. Next question. And I'm not sure how, as a moderator, you handle that sort of flagrant, willful, you know, refusal to abide by the rules. So anyway, make a long story short, I thought that it could have been, they might have crafted a few questions a little bit better. I don't think it was anywhere near the outrageous performance that by the moderators that the critics have made it out to be.
Well, that's a perfect setup for our montage. Let me play it. It's about a minute and a half. And then, Alan, I'll get you to weigh in on this as well. And this is a montage of questions from the moderators at the CNBC debate last week.
Without telling us that you try too hard or that you're a perfectionist, what is your biggest weakness and what are you doing to address it?
Dr. Carson, let's talk about taxes. You have a flat tax plan of 10% flat taxes, and I've looked at it, and this is something that is very appealing to a lot of voters, but I've had a really tough time trying to make the math work on this. If you were to take a 10% tax with the numbers right now on total personal income, you're going to come in with bringing in $1.5 trillion. That is less than half of what we bring in right now. And by the way, it's going to leave us in a $2 trillion hole. So what analysis got you to the point where you think this will work?
Mr. Trump.
Yes.
You've done very well in this campaign so far by promising to build a wall and make another country pay for it.
Right.
Send 11 million people out of the country. cut taxes $10 trillion without increasing the deficit.
Right.
And make Americans better off because your greatness would replace the stupidity and incompetence of others.
That's right.
Let's be honest. Is this a comic book version of a presidential campaign?
Senator Rubio, you yourself have said that you've had issues. You have a lack of bookkeeping skills. You accidentally intermingled campaign money with your personal money. You faced foreclosure on a second home that you bought. And just last year, you liquidated a $68,000 retirement fund. That's something that cost you thousands of dollars in taxes and penalties. In terms of all of that, it raises the question whether you have the maturity and the wisdom to leave a $17 trillion economy. What do you say?
And again, a montage of some of the questions asked at the CNBC debate last week. Questions to the Republicans. Alan, fair questions there from what you heard, whether they were answered or not?
Yes, I don't think I heard anything there that was out of bounds. Now, we can maybe quibble about that comic book question a little bit, and I think it was inartfully worded. The interesting thing in listening to that, though, is you hear that the questions from Becky, both dealing with economic issues, were better worded and more substantive and I think produced more interesting results than the other two, which kind of dealt a little more in kind of personalities. So I think one of the problems with that CNBC debate is it's a business channel. That was the stated theme of the debate. And if they had stuck to that, I think you could have had a really interesting substantive discussion. But, you know, there's this pressure on the moderators to produce theatrical moments and to, you know, sort of generate some sparks. And so I think sometimes these questions are designed for that purpose rather than eliciting information.
And Jim, do you think networks are competing with each other to sort of question the other networks?
I don't know about that, but I think they, you know, have seen it in a way that they haven't in the past as a real potential ratings and economic bonanza. You only have to look at the way CNN treated the run-up to their first shot at sponsoring debate. This was, remember, after the stunningly large audience for the first debate, which was sponsored by Fox, and you had the back and forth between the co-host Megyn Kelly and Trump, and that just got a huge amount of publicity. And CNN basically marketed it as if it was a championship prize fight on HBO or something. And it worked. They sort of went 24/7 with it in the days leading up to the actual event. They had the countdown clock going for Lord knows how long at the bottom right.
And the music, and, of course, right.
Yeah, and the fact that, you know, absent the I wondered during that final day leading up to that event that night how they would handle the start of World War III. I mean, would that be bottom right under the countdown clock? Or, you know, that North Korea just nuked Tokyo. I mean, I'm not quite sure if they would have interrupted regular programming from a Vegas, wherever the heck they were.
Well, Jim,
I got to interrupt
you now, only because we have to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Jim Warren and Alan Schroeder about the CNBC debate last week. Many of the Republicans complaining about the debate, the questions, the format, and the moderators. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about last week's Republican presidential debate on CNBC. I should add the next one is Tuesday night at 7 o'clock on the Lou Dobbs Show. That's on Fox Business. Also adding that tonight there's a Democratic forum on MSNBC hosted by Rachel Maddow. We're sort of deconstructing what happened last week, and we'll be talking about how to make for good debates, talking with Jim Warren, contributing editor at U.S. News and World Report, also chief media writer at the Poynter Institute for Media Studies, Alan Schroeder, professor in the School of Journalism at Northeastern University. He's written a number of books, including Presidential Debates, 50 Years of High-Risk TV. And we'd like you to join the conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I've always had a fantasy, and I don't think it'll come true in my lifetime, that when there are these debates, that there would be a fact-checking crawl that would happen almost simultaneously with the questions and with the answers. And Alan, as I said, I don't think that's physically possible to do that. But
well, no, but there's Twitter, which
there
sort of
Twitter.
Does exactly
you're
that
right.
same thing. And so, you know, if you're sitting there reading your Twitter feed as you're watching the debate, and increasingly that's how people are consuming these events, you do get kind of a real-time fact check. But it's an interesting point, because this whole thing about fact checking, I mean, the candidates can be quite brazen in what they say. Another example would be Ben Carson asked whether he had about his ties to this company, Manatech, and he basically just denied it in spite of overwhelming evidence to the contrary. But the dilemma for the moderators is, do you spend the debate time hashing over the details in a live fact check? Do you hope that the candidates fact check each other? Do you just let them get away with it? So I think that, you know, the beauty of these ancillary media, Twitter being a classic example here, mm-hmm. is that you do have that ability to fact check. Now, whether people pay as close attention to that as to the debate itself, that is another matter.
Jim, do you think these debates serve a good purpose?
Oh, yeah, terrific. You know, I think just seeing these guys out there, seeing them, you know, having to think fast on their feet, seeing some of the occasional spontaneous moments, all the more so in a world which has been so driven by, is so driven by paid media. Then, yeah, I think the more we can see these guys in action, the better. And, you know, we're going to get to a point fairly soon where they start winnowing down the field. They've already chopped two off the Fox News debate. I think two, at least one, at least Christie is off the main stage.
That's right.
And I know that Pataki and Lindsey Graham are off this sort of kiddie stage, number two stage. So that they're going to continue winnowing down. To a point where we probably only get closer to the Iowa caucuses, only have, you know, three or four or five folks, and it'll be a little bit easier to handle. But, you know, it's easy to, and I have chided the network, particularly CNN, for the way they market some of this stuff. But if the end result at a time of, as we know, tremendous voter disenchantment with the political system, at a time of, you know, continuing uninspiring voter turnout in local and state elections, if the end result is, for whatever reason, Donald Trump, whatever, to get people to watch and attempt to talk seriously about matters of policy and American politics and American foreign policy, I say, good. I cross my fingers somebody comes out with a little better understanding of who these folks are running for president.
And we should add that Huckabee is the other person who's been, I guess,
right.
demoted
That's
to
right.
the – Kids yep. table. I don't know, Alan. What do you? Is kids table? Is that a pejorative?
Yes, but
yes.
It's also pretty on target. I think undercard is perhaps the more politically correct term here, although that positions it as a boxing match, so I don't know how much better that is. But, you know, I think part of the problem with the dual track of the debates here, too, is that it puts the media who are sponsoring these things in the position of picking winners and losers. I mean, yes, the poll standings are what's influencing the decision here, but it might have been interesting, at least for the first couple of them, to mix it up a little bit more, have a random lottery to decide who gets on the stage, and also to more equitably divide the numbers so that you had maybe 7 and 7 instead of 10 and 4. But, you know, clearly there is a two-tiered system here.
What do you think about just the mix of moderators? And there have been some where pretty much one moderator has been asking the questions and calling the shots. Alan, does it matter? Does the number of moderators, does that make a difference?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, I think that's been a hallmark of this year's debates and a problem with the fact that the national cable news networks have now taken them over. They used to be much more local events where, let's say, the Des Moines Register or the newspaper in Manchester, New Hampshire would sponsor maybe with a local or national partner. Now there are these national television shows, and the networks all want to show off their talent. So you've got, in that CNBC debate, you have 6 people asking questions. Yeah. It's an absurd number of people to be asking questions when you also have 10 people on the stage. Mathematically alone, you know, it just means that pie is going to get sliced into very, very thin slivers.
Jim, do you see that as a problem?
Yeah, I think
Alan's totally correct. I've unmistakably the smacks of a certain sort of I know what you call it, Marty, maybe it's sort of internal institutional political correctness at some of these networks where, you know, you've got to have one of this, one of that. Then we've got our big ego stars. We've got to get them involved in it. So, you know, you had five or six people last week. It's interesting that last night I was on a public TV station in Chicago and discussing this with somebody who can, you know, some might call the father of presidential debates, a great man named Newton Minow, who's now 89 years old. In 1955, as a young legal counsel to the Illinois governor, Adlai Stevenson, who ran for president twice, he had suggested to Stevenson the notion of televised debates. Stevenson brings it up in 1960, and that's sort of the catalyst for the first televised debates. And Minow has been vice chairman on two occasions of the debates, I think it's 76 and 80, and he still has some role with the organization that takes over during the general election. He was telling me beforehand that they're bringing in three sort of network icons, retired icons, Jim Lehrer and Charles Gibson and Bob, the recently retired Bob Schieffer, as sort of advisors of some sort this time. And he noted very pointedly that each of those guys had handled the debate solo, or debates plural, solo. And I just think if you get somebody really good, that's the way to go.
In fact, I'm going to quote you, Jim, quoting Newton Minow. I'm looking at something you wrote on Pointer this morning. He found the debates, the debate we've been talking about, the CNBC debate, deplorable on all counts. It was embarrassing on the part of the candidates, the Republican National Committee, and also some of the journalists. The purpose of a debate is to educate the voters so they can make intelligent decisions on whom to support. In this case, it became a debate about the debates instead of on the issues. But I wonder, Alan, if it were really very focused on, you know, serious topics and there wasn't room for some of the verbal sparring, would people tune in for something like that?
Well, you do have to mix a little circus in with the bread here, I think. And so, but I think the unpredictability of debates kind of delivers you that as a given. But there are some things that could be done to kind of mix it up. One of the most interesting primary debates I saw was in the last cycle. It was in Washington, D.C., where the questions were asked by people in the audience who happened to be experts in various topic areas, very serious kind of wonky debate. But it was both interesting and substantive and entertaining even. So I think there are ways to do this that the networks probably, and because they're more self-interested in promoting their talent, that they're not really exploring all the creative possibilities in terms of format and that kind of thing.
That's Alan Schroeder. He's a professor in the School of Journalism at Northeastern University. Also with us, Jim Warren. He's a contributing editor at U.S. News and World Report, also chief media writer for the Pointer Institute for Media Studies. And we're talking in this hour of Radio Times about last week's debate, talking about perhaps there are ideas to make a better debate. And you can join the conversation. Again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. I see a lot of email questions coming in, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Now, a number of the Republicans complained that Anderson Cooper, CNN, much too easy on the Democrats when they had their debate on October 13th. Questions like, what was your favorite color? Let me play a montage, and this is Anderson Cooper asking some of the Democrats some questions on the CNN Democratic debate.
Welcome. I'm Anderson Cooper. Thanks for joining us. How can any kind of socialist win a general election in the United States? Will you say anything to get elected? You've only been a Democrat for a little more than 2 years. Why should Democratic voters trust you won't change again? What would your response to Vladimir Putin be right now in Syria? Why should Americans trust you with the country when they see what's going on in the city that you ran for more than 7 years? How can you credibly represent the views of the middle class? Do you change your political identity based on who you're talking to? What would you do for African Americans in this country that President Obama couldn't?
Jim, are those good questions?
Yeah, all very good. I mean, I think the caricature of Cooper and CNN having shilled during that debate for the Democrats is just not on point.
How about for you, Alan?
Yeah, I agree. And I think that, what goes on is that I doubt that the Republican candidates themselves even truly believe that they were treated more unfairly than the Democrats. But it plays so well to that Republican electorate to blame the media and talk about the liberal media and its unfairness and the double standards and all of that stuff. So they do it. You know, if you think about Ted Cruz in that last debate, he had this sort of rant in which he went through the litany of the, you know, inappropriate questions that had been asked. He had been asked a question about, do you agree with what the House just passed on the budget? So, you know, this idea of complaining instead of answering is a debate strategy that's pretty transparent, but it still seems to work. Newt Gingrich was the past master of this back in 2012.
Does it make them look like crybabies, Alan?
I think it does, and I think especially, you know, listening to that montage where you cut it all together like that, it does just sound like who can kind of outwhine the other guy.
In fact, I think Chris Christie said, you know, I'll answer any questions from anybody, anytime, any place. I mean, a very Chris Christie response, but I think raising questions about if you complain too much, you look kind of weak.
Yeah, and also Christie made the point, I think, a day or two after that, you know, if you're going to run for that particular job, you know, be ready to take on, you know, all queries, whether, you know, sophisticated, not sophisticated, none of the above, gratuitous, solicitous, groveling, or nasty. You got to be ready to handle all that stuff. And so bring it on. So I think he's right on that.
Let me read a couple of emails. One from Fred. He said, I thought Anderson Cooper asked some very tough questions of Hillary Clinton. We should compare these and how they were answered. The Democratic candidates did not cry foul and attack the moderators or refuse to stick to the time limits. We sort of addressed that. Here's an email from Paul. Great show, but I wonder if voters who believe what the various dishonest candidates say are on Twitter or any other platform where the lies are exposed. Problem is that belief overrides truth in this country, in my opinion. That's an email from Paul. I think there's some truth to that, Alan. You were talking about Twitter as a kind of a truth squad.
I do think there's truth to that. You know, there's this sort of epistemic closure going on, you know, in a lot of the electorate right now. So, you know, if we get to a point where facts don't matter at all, we're all in great big trouble here. But at least there's an ability for the record to be set straight, and not just on Twitter. I mean, most of the major news organizations do very good fact checking stories after the fact, and so at least the record exists now. Whether people pay attention to that record or not is another thing.
An email from C says, please stop the commentators from saying these guys when referencing the Republican candidates in the debate. Carly Fiorina was there. Jim, did that bother you the way it did C?
You know, sorry, I maybe it's mail me. I they went right past me. Sorry about that. But, you know, the previous emailer who used that phrase, I think something to the effect of belief can override truth. That's a good point to make. It reminds one, too, of the limits of these debates as tools to persuade people. I mean, for sure, history suggests that they're more likely, when they do have any sort of impact, to have an impact during the primary season, especially when you've got a lot of candidates and people really using them to winnow down the field. But when you get to the general election and the general election debate, I think it's very, very different, and people are sort of in a more partisan mode and watching to root on their guy, and history suggests they tend not to have a great deal of impact.
Jim, what do you think of having an audience at a debate? Is that a good thing?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I just, you know, all due respect to my friends, say, at C-SPAN, I don't want to, you know, turn this into, you know, a decorous session with my good friend Brian Lamb. I mean, this is, you know, the hurly-burly of the political system. I think it's fine. And it's like Congress, when people are talking about how nasty folks are and the Senate's out of control, I by and large think that it's all almost a little too decorous and gentlemanly or gentlewomanly, however I should put that.
Exactly.
And it's funny you mentioned that, Marty, because at that weird meeting, apparently Sunday night in Alexandria, Virginia, where the aides, the 14th candidates, met, one of the issues was the desire to do away with any shots, live shots of audience reactions. I mean, you know, it's absurd.
Yeah.
And it's part of it. Now, do you want to stack the audience so everybody, you know, are partisans for one candidate? No, one doesn't. But to have some human response and not make this quite so antiseptic, I think is a good thing.
Alan, does an audience serve a purpose?
It does. It certainly adds energy to the event. And you know, I like the term hurly-burly. I think that is part of the whole thing. The audience can become a distraction, and it can also tempt the candidates to pander. You know, you remember, we haven't seen it so much this cycle, but the last cycle out, there was the audience that booed the gay soldier. There was there was this whole sort of list of things that happened about the audience. And so that became a bit too much of the focus. So if the audience distracts from the candidates and their ability to debate each other, that's problematic. But just in general, having one there, I don't think is necessarily bad.
We're almost up on a break here, but Alan, going back to that boo, but wasn't that very revealing?
It sure was, and capital punishment was another thing that came up in that cycle and drew applause. You know, there was sort of a bloodlust on the part of some of the people in that audience, and it was revealing, and it was part of the story. But I think it unfairly disadvantaged the candidates a little bit because they're up on a stage, they're not hearing things exactly the same way, and I don't know. It created some confusion on the part of viewers. And it took away the focus from the candidates.
We're talking about debates in this hour of Radio Times, debates for the presidential nomination and eventually for the White House. That's Alan Schroeder. He's a professor in the School of Journalism at Northeastern University, author of several books, including Presidential Debates, 50 Years of High Risk TV. Also wrote a book called Celebrity in Chief, How Show Business Took Over the White House. Jim Warren is with us as well. He's a contributing editor at U.S. News and World Report, an award-winning reporter, columnist, and editor, and chief media writer for the Poynter Institute for Media Studies. Lots of people wanting to join our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Alan Schroeder and Jim Warren about debates, how to build better debates, and some deconstructings of the ones that we've already heard and watched this year. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Marilyn from, looks like Upper Black Eddy, to join us. Marilyn, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I found that last debate, the questions from CNBC, were just so disrespectful. And, like, what kind of answer are you going to get from somebody when you say, tell me your worst trait, you know? So, for me, if I want questions that let me know something about the candidate so I can decide whether or not to vote for them. And the thing about the Republicans is, every time they get on, the only people they talk to are people in their base. And I'm like, can you, if you want me to even think about you, can you talk to somebody like me who doesn't believe all this stuff that you're always saying?
Well, Marilyn,
it's so frustrating.
I hear you. But do you think, besides the first question that was asked at the CNBC debate, do you think there were substantive questions that allowed you to see some of the differences between the candidates and the parties?
There were things in some of the questions that I just thought were sort of snarky. Like when you say to Donald Trump, Do you have a comic book campaign? I mean, what? That's just, I just thought that was insulting. You know, I just don't understand the point of a question like that.
Okay, and something that we addressed earlier. Jim, do you want to respond to Marilyn's frustration?
No, I mean, we've discussed it. I you know, as Newton Minow, you know, who's seen more debates than all of us combined, last night on Chicago television said, you know, he found it all by and large deplorable. I personally slightly disagree. Mm-hmm. I think, as Alan noted too, there might have been some questions that could have been rephrased. You could have made the same point about Trump's seemingly outrageous statements and inconsistencies without using the phrase comic book campaign. But again, by and large, I thought they did a half-decent job with an inherently almost impossible task of dealing in a two-hour period with 10 big egos who all wanted to make their points, and then throw in the rules about, you know, allowing someone to respond to something that supposedly, you know, referenced them, and then your whole time schedule is out of whack and you got a further mess.
Alan, Ted Cruz floated an idea that having Republicans ask questions, I think his selection for moderators, Rush Limbaugh, Mark Levin, and Sean Hannity. And he also said if you've never voted for a Republican, you don't get to moderate a Republican debate. Now, that obviously didn't go anywhere. And I think he said it with a gun over his shoulder as well, just to make his point, I guess. But I guess you can say anything, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, Megyn Kelly on Fox News actually had the best response to that when she interviewed him. She said, does this mean you're going to look at our voting records? Do we have to tell you who we voted for? How are you going to know? And so, you know, it shows you the absurdity of this. Look, candidates are all about self-protection. They are risk averse, and debates terrify them because it is a very risky environment in which to operate. You know, you think about what they do day after day on the campaign trail. It's a very controlled schedule and a very controlled set of interactions with the public and the press. But you put them up on a debate stage, they really don't know what's going to happen. And so they get terrified and they start thinking of cute ways in which they could protect themselves.
Or end up saying, oops, right?
Exactly. And that's the end of the line for you when that happens.
I'm curious, Jim, and then we'll get back to our callers. And we also have some more questions here as well. Where did things stand with Telemundo? Now, my understanding was that that the debate was, what, is it been canceled or suspended with Telemundo?
Supposedly suspended. And for folks who have other things to do with their lives than get involved in the weeds as we are now leading and thus leading more rational lives than we, the one result of the CNBC debate was Mr. Priebus of the Republican National Party saying that they were suspending an upcoming debate that was going to be on Telemundo. And so I think that's where it is. Now, it is hard to believe that a party with such a giant challenge in attracting Spanish-speaking electorates is going to now basically turn their back on a huge Spanish-language network. Even though you've got the extenuating circumstances of Donald Trump,
right?
You know, having his own beef and with NBC and litigation over some Telemundo-related stuff and beauty pageants and all that. So that sort of complicates it. But it's hard to believe that at the end of the day, we're not going to see something involving a major Spanish language network.
Alan, let me read an email from Charlene. It says, I agree the value of debates, as your guests have described, but are the folks being drawn into politics for the first time learning what politics can only be from Trump and Carson? This is a concerning bar to set. She's worried about those people that are, you know, I guess, waking up or are young enough, and this is their introduction to politics. Do you share her concern?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that's an interesting point. You know, you think about somebody voting in his or her first election, and this slate of candidates this year is you know, quite different from the traditional way of looking at politics. But, you know, it's we live in a society that's constantly changing, and we adapt. And so I think, you know, one of the things that the debates can do for viewers of any level of political experience and sophistication is really, you know, let you see them side by side, do a little comparison shopping. If somebody comes off as too outrageous or too inexperienced, that's something that a debate can show you. And so, you know, they do have educational value that way, even though the non-traditional candidates seem to be the ones that are outperforming the traditional ones this year.
In fact, Jim, do you understand Ben Carson's popularity?
No. Simple as that, no. I think as some of the mystery, you know, is unraveled in coming months, I would not be surprised to see his standing along with that of Donald Trump to go down. I mean, I think there's a certain allure, there's a certain appealing surface personality, but I suspect if you go to Iowa right now and ask 10 questions about what his views are on certain issues, that's a little bit unclear to folks. As there is greater clarity, there'll be greater pressure on him. As you are now also seeing, there's greater pressure on him as a result of increased media scrutiny that comes with his surprise standing in the polls. Mm-hmm. Now, is he going to be able to deal with that? Or is he going to just, you know, turn his back and say, these are I gotcha questions, I'm not going to answer that stuff? You know, some of his seemingly odd, curious positions on various issues are going to undergo more scrutiny, as well as, I gather, in recent days, his own, you know, professional past with, you know, references to litigation that has been, you know, brought against him. But, you know, he is going to undergo scrutiny that's far greater than anything he's had up to this point. We'll see where he's at in another month or so.
I guess that's a downside of being number one. But to you, Alan, what I find so interesting is Ben Carson's very mild-mannered tone. But when you look at some of the things he said, you know, talking about Obamacare and comparing it to slavery, things like that, that the tone so often will override the content of what someone is saying.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's actually one of the keys to his success is that he has this demeanor that kind of invites you to lean in and listen, even as he is saying things that are you know, sort of bombastic and outrageous. So stylistics matter a great deal. But, you know, one of the things that he's not projecting is a kind of sense of confidence and leadership in the way that we think of for a president. And that would seem to be a prerequisite for the job.
Let me get Ira from Mount Holly, New Jersey, to join us on Radio Times. Ira, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yep. Good morning, Marty and your guests. I just wanted to make an observation. I find that watching and listening to debates is more like an entertainment show more than educational and informative. And I find it very difficult to be able to take away anything meaningful, you know, as far as the content is concerned coming from the candidates. And what I would like to see would be prepared questions that the candidates would all know beforehand, and even the public would know beforehand, and to give the candidates maybe a minute or 2 minutes or 3 minutes each to answer the question so that everybody knows what the question is, and the candidates would only be, you know, allowed to address the question. And then if the question is addressed, the people will know that it's being addressed. If it's not being addressed, people will know it's not being addressed, but at least we would know where the candidate stands and what they intend to do about the position. You know, the whole debate doesn't have to be that way, but maybe some, you know, creative way of doing that where it becomes more informative and less entertaining, because I found it very, you know, entertaining, and it shouldn't be about entertainment. It should be about information and education and giving people an opportunity to understand.
I appreciate the call. I'll give that to you, Alan. Almost sounds like a homework assignment.
Yeah, well, you know, the reality is that the candidates pretty well do anticipate what the questions are going to be, even if they're not literally written in advance, because in their preps, you know, they rehearse these things, and they're very good at predicting what journalists are going to ask. So they do sort of have that going in. As far as the entertainment value, I get the point, and I completely agree that you don't want these to turn into just pure entertainment, but on the other hand, it's political theater, and one of the reasons that people watch is because it is entertaining. So if you're drawing people into the tent and then serving them some politics, that may just be the price you have to pay to get people to watch.
Jim, what do you think about the idea that Donald Trump is going to be hosting Saturday Night Live? Now, Hillary Clinton was on Saturday Night Live. Are you troubled by that at all?
No, not at all. I mean, there are rules, you know, so-called fairness doctrine, and this could trigger what essentially amounts to free late-night advertising time on stations where they are now actively campaigning. It's somewhat arcanely written rule. So it's conceivable that as a result of this, all the other candidates will have to get free advertising time in places like Iowa and New Hampshire on stations, you know, sometime after, you know, 11:30 Eastern. Am I troubled? No, I mean, it is what it is. It's underscoring the nexus that he represents between politics and entertainment. I wouldn't want to say that it is without risk for him. I mean, you know, it maybe in some fashion backfires. I suspect not. But to a certain group of people will only sort of add to the celebrity allure that I think is already somewhat on the wane. And I really will be surprised if he is in a front runner or a secondary position by the time that the Iowa caucuses take place. But am I troubled? No. I mean, you know, ever since Bill Clinton went on what it was in Arsenio Hall and, God, how many years ago was that? Like 19?
Long time.
92, yeah.
With his saxophone, this is all part of the same continuum.
If that was as far back as the pharaohs and the tombs. To you, Alan, are you bothered at all by that?
I'm not. Look, I think that he's kind of crazy to do it. If you think about when they had Sarah Palin on, they made her look like an idiot, and she was right there on the stage with them. And Saturday Night Live is actually pretty cruel to the candidates, and they, you know, they're not in the bag for any of these people. Their job is to make fun of them. And I guess, you know, maybe if you go on, it looks like you're a good sport, but on the other hand, you could look like the butt of some pretty serious jokes.
Let me squeeze one more caller on. I'm not sure. There's a lot of commotion behind in someone's phone here. Let me get John from Fishtown to join us. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
I just wanted to hear any comments on in the original Democratic debate, there were a lot of online polls that said Bernie Sanders was ahead. And even within the same polling entities, those sites like CNN and NBC said in their internal polls that Bernie Sanders won by like 70%, but their headlines all read Hillary won. And there was a huge disconnect there, and there was a lot of discussion about that, but I haven't heard discussion here. And I'll take this off the line because my phone's going.
Sure, John. No, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And, Alan, you know, disagreeing with who was called a winner, is it also a mistake to think of winners and losers when it comes to these debates?
Well, yes and no. You almost can't help but do it because it is a competitive situation. Look, only one of them is going to become the nominee, and so they are competing. So I don't think it's inappropriate to evaluate debates along the lines of who wins and who loses. But the caller does raise an interesting point, right, which is that there's often a disconnect between who the pundits think won and who segments of the population think won. So, you know, there's a lot of opinion involved in this, and I say that as someone who critiques the debates after they're over. I know that my opinion may not be everybody else's.
Well, we're almost out of time here. There is a forum tonight, Alan, and this is on MSNBC, hosted by Rachel Maddow, with the three Democratic candidates. What, anything you'll be looking for in particular?
Well, a forum differs from a debate in that it's a one-on-one serial interviews rather than everybody up there at the same time doing back and forth. So it's a kind of friendlier environment for the candidates. The candidates typically have more time. And Rachel Maddow, I think, is a very good interviewer, obviously really smart. And so I'll be interested in her line of questioning. I don't think she's going to let them get away with much. I don't think it'll be nearly as lively as a debate will, just by virtue of the fact that they're not all there together.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times, Alan Troeter.
Thank you, Marty.
And you're welcome. He's a professor in the School of Journalism at Northeastern University, wrote a book called Presidential Debates. Jim Warren, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Hey, my pleasure, guys. It's great.
And he's a contributing editor at U.S. News and World Report and also chief media writer for the Poynter Institute for Media Studies. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.